Are you ready to make the most of your oil and gas mineral rights? Welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. Get the knowledge and resources you need to manage your minerals and royalties. Here is your host, Matt Sands.
Hello and welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Sands, and I'm here to help you make the most of your mineral rights and royalties. And my co-host, Justin Williams, joins me as well. Hey, Justin, how are you doing today?
Good morning, Matt. Doing well.
So apologize as we're recording this. There might be some background noise on my end. I have some construction going on in my house. So we're going to press on because we wanted to keep you informed and keep you on top of the latest happenings in oil and gas and mineral rights and royalties. And what we wanted to talk about today is the ESG movement. And Justin, I know this particular term, ESG, can certainly be thought of as having potential benefits, but then at the same rate, a lot of controversy that goes with it.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's one of those drive-by phrases that we've been hearing more and more of in the last couple of years. But at least for me, it wasn't really clear exactly what this is and why is it coming up in conversation with companies. You know, you hear it making impacts or companies doing different things because of it, but why?
Yeah, so that's what we wanted to talk about today is really what does ESG mean? Where did the term come from? And specifically, what are the principles and the types of things when you hear the term ESG, what's it supposed to be doing in terms of identifying how a company is doing around certain principles? And that is specifically three things, and that's the environmental, social, and governance. And we'll talk more about exactly what that means. But it was interesting as we were doing the research for this episode, Justin, because, you know, like you, I've heard the term ESG for a number of years, and I always hear it in the context of, you know, sort of anti-fossil fuels and moving towards, you know, lower greenhouse gas emissions like wind and solar. And really, it's interesting, though, it covers a lot more than that.
It does. And, you know, I think from a high level, when we go through the list, which we will in just a minute, it's hard to really say, okay, you know, I agree with these from a high level standpoint, but it really comes down to how are we implementing these and what are the impacts that we're having. And Matt, you know, I thought that it was interesting that this term was not something that just came out of anywhere. You know, it's widely believed to originate in the UN Who Cares Wins report in 2004. The report refers to a UN Global Compact launched in July 2000 by the United Nations. The Global Compact is an international initiative bringing companies together with UN agencies, labor, and civil society to support 10 principles in the areas of human rights, working conditions, the environment, and anti-corruption. Through the power of the collective action, the Global Compact seeks to advance responsible corporate citizenship so that the business can be part of the solution to the challenges of globalization. In this way, the private sector, in partnership with other social actors, can help realize this vision, a more stable and inclusive global economy. So Matt, that sounds really great when you put it together, and kudos to who wrote that statement. Would you like to go through, Matt, the first couple principles here?
Sure. Yeah. So the principles mentioned in that UN Global Compact are really around those four areas. Again, that human rights, the first one, and that really is talking about supporting and protecting human rights in their day-to-day activities, and that they're not complicit in human rights abuses. And so those are kind of the key principles. Similar to that, in the kind of another category, they have labor as a principle, and they have under that basically the freedom for association and for employees to join together in collective bargaining, in other words, forming a union, elimination of forced labor, slave labor, abolition of child labor, and then, you know, eliminating discrimination and in terms of employment and occupation. So that means based on your gender, sexual orientation, and things like that. So basically, it's, you know, non-discrimination. So those are a couple of the human rights and labor principles. Justin, you want to talk about the environment and sort of the governance side?
Absolutely. And this environment piece seems to be what we're hearing the most about, but it mentions that businesses should support a precautionary approach to environmental changes. They should undertake initiatives to promote greater environmental responsibility, and they should encourage and promote new environmentally friendly technologies. Again, from a high level, hard to disagree with that. It also mentions anti-corruption. Businesses should work against corruption in all of its forms, including extortion and bribery. So at a high level, I don't disagree with any of those principles, I don't think.
Yeah, I agree.
So the Who Cares Wins report proposed the categorization of these principles under the headings of environmental, social, and governance. Specifically, it mentions environmental issues, so climate change and related risk, the need to reduce those toxic releases and waste, and the new regulation expanding the boundaries of environmental liability with regard to products and services. With that is an increased pressure by civil society to improve performance, transparency, and accountability, leading to reputation risk if not managed properly, emerging markets for environmental services, and environmental-friendly products. And so that's pretty in-depth, but again, it's nothing that seems too far-fetched. And in social issues, it kind of goes on here and expands on that. Workplace health and safety, community relations, human rights issues in the context of suppliers and contractors, government and community relations, increasing pressure to improve that performance and transparency, and so on so forth. So on top of that, corporate governance issues, board structure and accountability, accounting and disclosure practices, and then audit committee structure, independence of auditors, executive compensation, and then management of corruption and bribery issues. And you know, I think something that we don't hear a lot, but the reporting for ESG is something that, you know, for a large company, I think it's been a concern because it's a new process and something that they have to get used to. And it's really evolved over the past 16 years, Matt. It started out as a small percentage of asset managers and companies subscribing to sustainability to over 2,450 signatories representing over 80 trillion in assets under management committing to ESG. One of the biggest issues with ESG is that lack of consistency and transparency around those reporting of those metrics. No surprise that the Big Four consulting firms are putting together a set of metrics designed to create a systematic market-driven metric system. It makes you wonder just how much they're getting paid to put this together, but it certainly isn't being done out of the kindness of their hearts. You know, I think this is something, Matt, that is going to be really important for ESG because we really need to see how these changes are impacting the goal overall.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, the thing with these metrics, and the World Economic Forum has a framework that they put together, and we'll talk about some of the specifics there. But before we get to that, I think one of the biggest issues that a lot of people have with the ESG movement in general is that it's so subjective. Like we've talked about, and like you mentioned, Justin, it seems to favor the environmental side of things and, you know, looking at lower greenhouse gas emissions technologies while maybe showing a little bit of a blind eye or, you know, ignoring the issues around social and governance, you know, specifically. If we talk about the manufacturing of solar panels and you look at China, you know, one of the big complaints is that we sort of ignore the fact that they have historically used slave labor in the process of making the solar panels. And then similarly, you know, there was a big ruckus a few years ago with Apple and their supplier Foxconn in China, who is accused of labor abuses at an iPhone factory. And so it caused Apple to have to make adjustments to supplier requirements and relationships as a result of that. And so they sort of only when that kind of reached a boiling point did you hear about that. It wasn't something that was proactively managed. And I think, again, that just goes to the subjectivity of ESG. You know, each company sort of left to their own devices to focus on that. And the asset managers in particular are really the biggest drivers of this. You have BlackRock, who are very outspoken around ESG investing, State Street and other large asset managers, that's you know, one of the primary focuses. And they actually are wielding a lot of weight in the form of the trillions of dollars of retirement accounts and all of the assets that they're managing on behalf of the investors. And so they can sort of basically dictate how companies need to manage those issues around environment, social, and governance. And so it's been driving a particular narrative around divesting from fossil fuels and investing in what's perceived as, you know, a green energy in terms of solar and wind in particular. And so I think there's some ulterior motives behind it, which is what doesn't sit well with me. I think, you know, in principle, all of these things are good and all of these things are principles that companies should be following. And it comes down to when you need to measure the specifics is where the issues are, I think, Justin. That's the big thing is, you know, that lack of consistency and transparency, like you mentioned. And I'll say that it does incentivize companies to do the right thing to the extent that they are measuring it objectively and they are following those principles that are being developed in that framework that's being developed. But you know, on the other hand, I think there are some definite cons to the ESG movement. So I don't know if you want to talk about some of those.
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. And as you mentioned, you know, a pro of this is we're incentivizing companies to do the right thing, and the devil's in the details. So some of the cons, you know, as we've talked about, it promotes greenwashing. You know, Google is 100% renewable. They're still using the power grid, which is a majority of coal and natural gas, but they're simply buying those green energy and offsetting carbon emissions. And in my mind, Matt, there's some real questions as to overall for the end goal, how much of an impact is that really having aside from making a good marketing ploy? You know, who knows, and time will tell. It allows groups pushing for that particular narrative, as Matt mentioned. And some of these firms like BlackRock, they just have far too much power to force companies into that narrative. And maybe that's good, maybe that's bad, but I think it's certainly going to have unintended consequences. And we're certainly seeing some of that being talked about now.
There's a report that was published in 2020 called The Unintended Consequences of ESG Activism by the Pacific Research Institute. And it mentions this specifically. So BlackRock is the largest asset manager in the world. They have $7.4 trillion in assets as of end of 2019. To put that in perspective, their holdings are 8% of the total value of the global stock market. So they have an extremely high level of influence over what happens in the boardroom of these major companies that they're invested in. And the thing that is interesting that therefore is basically being forced by some of these environmental activists to enforce a particular climate change rhetoric and or direction. And so what they mentioned, and after this kind of criticism reached a certain point, that they will, quote, avoid investments in companies that have high sustainability related risk, a move the firm CEO Larry Fink says will fundamentally change how American companies conduct business. So they really just stated it right there. They're fundamentally changing the way that companies that are being influenced by the ESG movement, how they do their day-to-day business and the decisions that they make. And they operationalize that by divesting, you know, exiting investments in coal production and fossil fuel stocks, at least before 2022, when they came out and said, actually, we were wrong. We don't want to divest from fossil fuels. But I think to a certain extent, a lot of the slowdown in investment in the energy industry is a lot to do with the ESG movement, because companies aren't able to get funding to reinvest and to grow production and things like that. Now, certainly there's other issues like we talked about with companies needing to live within cash flow and needing to make sure they stay profitable. And so that's obviously a big driver. But I think specifically, if you look at the last year, all of the headlines around oil and gas companies really focusing on share buybacks and also increasing dividends rather than drilling additional wells with some of the cash that they invested. And that's money that could have been reinvested in drilling new wells. And I think a lot of these pressures are forcing them to do that. And so, you know, if you didn't have this backdrop of the ESG movement, it'd be interesting, Justin, would they be drilling more wells right now? You know, all things being equal, if there wasn't this difficulty in getting access to capital, and all of the things you hear in the news, you're bad. We don't want any more fossil fuels. So they have to make these decisions based on the set of regulations, a set of rules that are consistent, so that they know when it comes time for that asset to start producing that they can actually operate it. You know, they're not going to make an investment that is going to be a sunk cost if they, you know, get blocked by some permitting issues or something like that. So that's also part of the issue. So a lot of nuance to this, but that is one of the biggest issues I see.
Absolutely, Matt. And like you said, I mean, it truly is fundamentally changing how businesses are doing business. And I think the oil and gas industry is no exception. They kind of see the writing on the wall and they're, you know, thinking about how they can diversify their energy production and looking at other options. You know, another thing, Matt, we talk about this a lot, which is a little bit of a taboo subject, or this gets talked about a lot, but climate models, you know, what if we find that we've been heading down the wrong path, a more expensive path for less reliable energy? It'll really make a huge impact. And right now we're kind of in a mode of characterizing all fossil fuels as dirty, which I think is really a shame, because as we've talked about, Matt, natural gas is going to be a huge tool in the transition to cleaner energy. And we've seen in the last couple months that there's been a little bit of change of tune with some of the firms about that. But certainly something interested to see how that plays out. It also seems that we're very wind and solar focused, which, Matt, we've talked about this kind of ad nauseum at this point. It seems like there's so much better options such as nuclear and other things to look at. It's kind of a shame that we're being forced down this path.
Yeah, it's sort of like the ESG movement is picking the winners in terms of, you know, energy, and really the free market should be doing this based on the reliability, the cost. And then I do agree there needs to be an environmental aspect because we don't want to pollute the planet and all of that, but there needs to be a balance, right? So there needs to be a look at the full life cycle CO2 emissions. And if you look at nuclear, it's really interesting that you have this big focus on wind and solar, to your point, Justin. So I think that the hypocrisy of that is really interesting because it favors wind and solar, you know, politically over fossil fuels and nuclear. But I think that is potentially immoral because you're restricting developing countries' access to energy, which is critical for human flourishing. You know, you have 800 million people have no electricity, and 2.6 billion people across the world are still using wood or dung for heating and cooking. And the amount of deaths due to that from breathing that smoke in, you know, we're not talking about that. Holistically, you need to be looking at those types of things, you know, in the context of the environmental and the social side of things and saying, well, yeah, nuclear has some carbon emissions with it. You know, a natural gas-fired power plant has some carbon emissions with it, but the net positive, because we're 600 million people now have access to cheap and reliable electricity, and they're not burning wood or dung, which emits more CO2, right? So it's the holistic view that's being totally ignored. You know, if ESG was truly objective, if maybe we can get there, then it'll be a good thing to where we're talking about those types of things and promoting what's best and looking at it objectively in terms of the pros and the cons of whatever option it is. And not just the cons, which is when you talk about fossil fuels, the only thing that gets talked about are the side effects, which is a shame.
I could agree more, Matt. And, you know, I think for me, the one thing I would really like to see is in this list of core principles, you know, ensuring that there's access to cheap and reliable energy to bring third world countries out of poverty, I think is very important. And it really should be a fundamental bedrock of the ESG movement, because we certainly, as you mentioned, Matt, we want those people to have that access to clean energy. And as we spoke, as Alex mentioned when we spoke with him, that really is the difference when you look at countries like the United States versus a third world country. We have easy access to energy that powers our computers and everything else that we do every day. I think another important thing that's not getting talked about is, how are we ensuring continuous improvement in this ESG cycle or renewables or anything else? You know, I think, as you mentioned, Matt, kind of the history has been that we go down these roads and we find ourselves in a certain situation, and then we look in the rearview mirror and go, oh my gosh, well, that obviously wasn't the correct thing to do. But with these metrics, it would be great if we were having a bigger conversation and letting the numbers tell us what does and does not work. And I think if we were doing that, nuclear would become a very clear option to a path forward.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I think to hit on that point that you mentioned about, you know, making sure that we're lifting people out of poverty as really a definite vision for the future. And so you look at the World Economic Forum report around these concepts and kind of tied to these metrics that those big four consulting firms are putting together. You know, a couple of things that are talked about in there are the net economic contribution, and then you also have community investment. And so are you giving back to community partnerships? Are you, you know, giving back to the community and lifting up those communities out of poverty? And I think that is a key thing that needs to be talked more about, because I think if you had it, you know, if all of these things were looked at objectively and without a political motivation, which I think is probably never going to happen, but we can all dream. I think if that were the case, then you'd see maybe putting a natural gas-fired power plant is the best option for this community, you know, not the wind turbines and solar panels, because, you know, they don't have electricity. We're introducing electricity. We're building a hospital there. Well, that hospital needs to have reliable power, because the neonatal unit, the incubators, they can't be at the whim of when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. You know, babies don't come and they're not born, you know, during the day always. And so at nighttime, well, then you'd have a problem if you needed to have some of those critical care equipment and facilities up and running. Well, you need a reliable power source like natural gas or nuclear. So those are the types of things we need to be looking at, that it's such a deep and nuanced discussion. And oftentimes we just kind of gloss over that and focus on whatever narrative that we're trying to drive, whether it's lower greenhouse gas emissions or whatever the situation is. And then we ignore everything else, which is not good. And I think that's why, you know, in total, I would say the ESG movement has been used as a political tool and really driving investment in particular technologies rather than an objective measure of how good the company is doing, you know, in terms of these non-financial measures that we're talking about here.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's pretty obvious through talking through it, you know, the ESG movement overall, its effect on oil and gas companies and by virtue of mineral and royalty owners, it really at this moment seems to be pretty negative generally. I mean, this big push towards eliminating fossil fuels is certainly not helping us. And it's good to see that the conversation is coming back a little bit to being reasonable about natural gas. But overall, Matt, you know, it's not looking super great for fossil fuels as far as ESG goes.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, case in point, Royal Dutch Shell, there was a big lawsuit that environmentalists won in the Netherlands last year requiring them to decrease emissions by a certain amount and to meet certain requirements that were really just not feasible. So what it really forced Royal Dutch Shell to do is to move their headquarters to London and become a UK-only registered company. And let me tell you, this is a massive shift for Shell, a company that I used to work for. Used to be registered in both London and in the Netherlands, and kind of joint governance between the two countries. It had been, you know, for hundreds of years. Yeah, you know, this is a lot of history that goes into when Shell Transport and Training and Royal Dutch, those two companies merged to form Royal Dutch Shell. And so really bad situation for shareholders, at least in the short term. I think they are, you know, it's a great company still and they're moving forward. But I think that's a good example of how, you know, a company that I think really is probably one of the best from an ESG standpoint in the oil and gas industry in terms of very stringently monitoring bribery, trying to do the right thing from an environmental standpoint, governance-wise, making sure they have representation from minority groups and women, leadership positions, and all of those things that companies should be doing. You know, they were doing all of that, yet they were attacked because of the environmental side. And so then they had to make a significant governance change by closing their affiliation with Holland in the Netherlands, you know, officially. And, you know, I think they probably still have offices and people working there, obviously, but from a standpoint of, you know, where they're paying taxes and where they're registered, they're in the UK now. And so I think the Netherlands loses out in that case. And the environmentalists, you know, they get a victory, but, you know, I think it really hurts the shareholders and it hurts all those families and people in the Netherlands that worked for Royal Dutch Shell there. So similarly, I think you look at, to harp on this again, financial institutions really promoting investments in certain technologies and wind and solar under the environmental part of ESG, saying that, well, we're reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we need to be net zero at a certain point. But to get there, they're ignoring the fact that child labor is used in cobalt mining in the Congo. And then China using Uyghur slave labor to manufacture solar panels has been documented. And we'll link to a couple articles from the BBC and others that have talked about these issues. And to me, that is, you know, if we're having an objective conversation about this and saying, well, you know, if we're going to move towards clean energy, well, how do we do it so that we're making sure the S and the G part of ESG are also considered? And I think if that were truly the case, you wouldn't see such a big push towards solar in particular, just because of the issues that China's had around their supply chain and using forced labor and things like that. And I think these are conversations we need to be having, because at the end of the day, like you mentioned, Justin, the goal is to get everyone to the same level, access to cheap and reliable energy, out of energy poverty, not burning wood and dung to cook and to heat their homes, to have access to electricity. And in order to do that, you need to have everything, right? So I'm not saying that wind and solar is bad. I do think we need wind and solar, and we need nuclear, and we need fossil fuels for sure. And we need more of everything. It's just, we need to do it in the right way and in the way that it's not favoring one technology over the other, right?
I couldn't agree more, Matt. And, you know, I think something that, or a plea that I have in with ESG is we talk a lot about in the United States that we want to do the drilling here because our companies here are the most committed to those social governance. And, you know, I think that the same applies with renewables and moving towards green energy. I really would like to our politicians quit putting the oil and gas companies on the stand and accusing them and let them be a force for good in developing the technologies that we're going to use tomorrow. And I think something that, you know, we miss often is we talk about oil and gas companies, but truly Shell, BP, all of these companies, they are energy companies first. They are not just oil and gas companies, and their operations are much larger than just going out and drilling wells. And I think these companies often have the best technology available and the best idea on how to get us to a marketable energy source for renewables. And that's not something we're talking about now.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think that we need to have, you know, everybody come together. It needs to be a collaborative effort to get us there because it is a technical challenge. It is a big challenge to get the growing population of this planet in out of energy poverty, you know, protecting the environment at the same time. And, you know, to your point, if we were truly concerned about that from an ESG standpoint, the conversation ought to be is how do we drill more oil and gas in the United States? You know, I think we talked about this recently in our episode where we talked about Jamie Dimon with JP Morgan Chase saying, you know, we absolutely need to drill more oil and gas here in the US. It's the right thing to do just because of all the reasons we just mentioned. And so it's good to see influential people, whether you agree with their stance or their background or, you know, bailouts and whatever, you know, that it's good to hear them beating that drum because I think it is coming back. I think we've gone too far on the ESG bandwagon, so to speak, and now we're coming back into more sensible approach. And I think it's just because physics always wins, you know, as it comes to, you can be, you know, like Doomberg says, you know, in the war between platitudes and physics, physics always wins. And so you can be saying all these great things about whatever technology it is, you know, some magical fairy dust that generates electricity or wind or solar or whatever it is. But if it doesn't meet the needs, you know, the technical requirements, you know, in terms of providing the required supply of electricity when it's needed, well, you know, that's an issue, right? And the physics of that doesn't match up with the demand. And so you need to look at what are the other options? How do we get there to equal those out so that we, when you go to flip on the switch, the lights come on. That's the end of the day, the, you know, simple terms, what I'm talking about. So, you know, a lot to think about. I think the real takeaway here for mineral and royalty owners is from an ESG standpoint, if you're a shareholder of some of these publicly traded oil and gas companies, you know, some of these, the influence of this comes through proposals. So when you get your proxy vote, you know, the form in the mail for the annual shareholder meeting, don't just throw it away or shred it like I used to do. You know, sit down and take a look at what the shareholder recommendations are. And some of them are being overly influenced by companies like BlackRock or environmental groups. And so we need to vote our shares and vote no on these proposals that don't make sense, that are going against what the principles of ESG are and really just forcing a particular theme, whether it's reducing greenhouse gas emissions or whatever it is. So I think we need to look at it in totality is the moral of the story. ESG, you know, it's just, you know, a set of principles, which in principle, you know, it's not bad. It's really is how is put into action is where we're seeing the issues. And so I think that's the big thing to take away here.
You nailed it, Matt. And I think that, you know, ESG overall, it's ambiguous on a high level, and it kind of leaves some room for the political winds to blow. So it'll be interesting to see over the next, you know, 10 years if the narrative changes a little bit or if we continue down the same path exactly.
Yep, I agree completely. And on that note, that wraps up this episode. As always, you can find links to the resources we mentioned in this episode in the show notes at mineralrightspodcast.com. Until next time. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mineral Rights Podcast with your host, Matt Sands. Don't forget to subscribe and share at mineralrightspodcast.com. The Mineral Rights Podcast should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy.